Welcome to the Kanem, where humans and aliens converse, and where all the dots are connected. I'm Nancy of Zeta Talk, an emissary for aliens from Zeta Reticuli. They are here to warn of great cataclysms on Earth and advise how to survive this. The pending pole shift is not the end. Man will make his next leap forward to live a better time when aliens will live among us. What the Zetas said about the period of gloom from volcanic dust after the pole shift, which they have predicted to last for 25 years, diminishing, of course, during that time until we are again at sunlight as today. Just how much light can we expect from the sun? And I quote from Zeta Talk, Gloom, written August 10, 2002. We have stated that the Earth will be under volcanic dust gloom for 25 years. Obviously, this will depend upon region, proximity to burping volcanoes, being down or upwind of same, and elevation. Volcanic gloom is always heavier within 1,000 miles downwind from the volcano. Thus, if one is outside of the downwind corridor, one escapes this heavy fallout. Volcanic gloom is always heavier at lower elevations in such places, as the heavier particles fall back to Earth after being airborne by the force of heat rising or explosions, and high elevations some 500 miles downwind from a burping volcano might find they have less dust than a lower elevation 1,000 miles downwind. The size of the volcano also matters, and whether it is underwater or above ground. As silly as this statement seems, this is something to consider when planning a survival location. Remember that the sea level will rise, our estimate some 675 feet above current levels. If a volcano, such as those in Indonesia or the Philippines or Central America, goes underwater during this time, the ash will be carried by water, not air. Also, some volcanoes ooze, others belch, and the amount of ash differs. Thus, some areas will find themselves groping through the dusk for 40 years, as Moses reported where he wandered just east of the volcanoes in the Mediterranean, and other locations will find the gloom like overcast days, the sun rarely shining through, but occasional sunlight beaming through like a promise. In those areas, which can be plotted by careful analysis of the new geography and factors to be considered, survivors will find vegetation struggling through, but crops will still be pathetic to non-existent. These areas will find, after 15 years, that the gloomy days are lightening up and think this a return to normalcy in their joy. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Gloom. Well, this sounds terrible, but it's not the nuclear winter many assume. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Nuclear Winter, written February 2002. The nuclear winter, much discussed during the Cold War, in fact does not occur during heavy volcanic ash times. Has this occurred in the past? Mankind surmises this with the extinction of the dinosaurs attributed to heavy ash. This is all speculation, and as we have stated, the dinosaur died because of a virus, not a meteor strike. Sunlight warms even if it cannot make it through the clouds. It warms the clouds, the air, etc. Thus, especially since the core is warming the Earth today with its increased swirling, you can expect that the core will continue to make the globe warmer after the shift. In addition, the atmosphere will be torn away, so the clouds will be lower and the atmosphere less of a block to the warmth of the sunlight than today. All reasons for the gloom to stay warm, which it will. You can anticipate the same degree of warmth per latitude that you experience today. Sunburn and radiation are suppressed by the ash cloud, the one advantage. End of the quote from Zeta Talk, Nuclear Winter. Well, and there will be almost continuous drizzle to deal with, this also affecting the gloom. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Drizzle, written November 30th, 2002. Drizzle occurs most certainly during the months following the shift, and thereafter depending upon location. The atmosphere is low, clouds low, as the atmosphere was stripped away during the shift and must rebuild. Thus, clouds being low is like continuous fog, and fog settles out in the form of rain or drizzle upon any slight temperature change. If the land is downwind from a large water source, like a lake or ocean, then certainly there will be fog and drizzle until the atmosphere rebuilds. Continuous drizzle, as has been predicted for the world for some 25 years, during the time when volcanic gloom will also prevail and the clouds lie close to the ground. There is a nexus between volcanic gloom and the continuous drizzle we have predicted in the aftertime. The volcanic gloom, where wafts into the upper atmosphere, is less devastating than when held close to the ground, but this is what will be occurring. The atmosphere is low, and the volcanic dust can only rise so high. It is no secret that rain often is incited by dust, water forming around a particle, and this process will be in place worldwide. It is the rain, to some degree, which cleans the air of the fine volcanic dust that will blow about otherwise, seemingly endlessly. Thus, there is a relationship, the 25 years we have predicted for volcanic gloom also being in place for continuous drizzle. This is not to say that survivors must live in their raincoats, as this will be a reducing phenomenon over 25 years. End of the quote from Zeta Tau on drizzle. What does folklore tell us? The last full shift occurred during the Jewish Exodus and was documented in the Bible and various papyrus from Egypt. Where this part of the world, near a number of volcanoes in the Mediterranean and its environs, suffered more volcanic dust than most lands, it is nevertheless descriptive of just how gloomy it can be, probably a worst-case scenario. But Villikowski recorded folklore from around the world in his book, Worlds in Collision, that were related to the gloom that descended from volcanic dust around the world. And I quote, "If the eruption of a single volcano can darken the atmosphere over the entire globe, a simultaneous and prolonged eruption of thousands of volcanoes would blacken the sky. Volcanoes vomit water vapor as well as cinders. Following the cataclysm, the author of Codex Chimalpopoca, in his History of the Suns, shows us a terrifying celestial phenomenon, followed by darkness that covered the face of the earth, in one instance for a period of 25 years. In the years of this gloom, when the world was covered with clouds and shrouded in mist, the Quiche tribe migrated to Mexico, crossing a sea enveloped in a somber fog. In the manuscript Quiche, it is also narrated that there was little light on the surface of the earth. The faces of the sun and of the moon were covered with clouds. In the Hermitage Papyrus in Leningrad, there are lamentations about a terrible catastrophe when heaven and earth turned upside down. After this catastrophe, darkness covered the earth. The sun is veiled and shines not in the sight of men. None can live when the sun is veiled by clouds. None knoweth that midday is there. The shadow is not discerned. Not dazzled is the sight when the sun is beheld. He is in the sky like the moon." In this description, the light of the sun is compared to the light of the moon, but even in the light of the moon, objects cast a shadow. If the midday could not be discerned, the disk of the sun was not clearly visible, and only its diffused light made the day different from the night. The gloom gradually lifted with the passing years as the clouds became less thick. Little by little, the sky and the sun appeared less and less veiled. It is the time of the wandering of the Israelites in the desert. The shadow of death is related to the time of the wandering in the desert after the Exodus from Egypt. The sinister meaning of the words, shadow of death, corresponds with the description of the Hermitage Papyrus. None can live when the sun is veiled by clouds. The phenomenon of gloom enduring for years impressed itself on the memory of the 12 tribes and is mentioned in many passages in the Bible. Psalms 44:19. The people that walked in darkness, in the land of the shadow of death. Isaiah 9:2. And the Lord brought them out of darkness and the shadow of death. Nihongi, a chronicle of Japan from the earliest period, refers to a time when there was continuous darkness and no difference of day and night. It describes in the name of the Emperor Kami Yamato an ancient time when the world was given over to widespread desolation. It was an age of darkness and disorder. In this gloom, Hikoho no Miji no Mikoto fostered justice and so governed this western border. In China, the annals telling of the time of the Emperor Yahu refers to the Valley of Obscurity and to the somber residence as a place of astronomical observations. The name Shadow of Death expresses the influence of the sunless gloom upon the life processes. The Chinese annals of Wang Shixing, in the chapter dealing with the 10 stems, the Earth's primeval history, relate that at Wu, the 6th stem, darkness destroyed the growth of all things. The migration in central Polynesia, shrouded in gloom, is narrated in the tradition of the aborigines of this part of the world about a chief named Te Eru, who lived long in utter darkness in Avika, who migrated in a canoe named Weary of Darkness to find a land of light, and who, after many years of wandering, saw the sky clearing little by little and arrived at a region where they could see each other clearly. In the Kalevala, the Finnish epos which dates back to an enormous antiquity, the time when the sun and the moon disappeared from the sky and dreaded shadows covered it. The dreaded shadow covered the earth when Ukko, the highest of the Finnish deities, relinquished the support of the heavens. Hailstones of iron rained down furiously, and then the world became shrouded in a generation-long darkness. Vegetation died in the catastrophe. The Iranian Book of Buhanas says blight was diffused over the vegetation, and it withered away immediately. When the sky was shattered, the day became dark, and the earth teemed with noxious creatures. For a long time there was no green thing seen. Seeds would not germinate in a sunless world. It took many years before the earth again brought forth vegetation. This is told in the written and oral traditions of many peoples. According to American sources, the regeneration of the world and of humankind took place under the veil of the gloomy shadows, and the time is indicated as the end of the 15th year of the darkness, 10 years before the end of the gloom. End of the quote. Ah, before you lose hope, bear with us, because we're going to tell you how to make the light of day with pencil leads.
I'm happy to welcome back Mike, a strong contributor to the Troubled Times Forum. Mike has posted for years about survival sites and how to work with electricity, electrical networks, how to work with batteries, how to set up windmill, watermill, bike generating rigs. Very knowledgeable, and we're delighted to have him with us again to talk about how life will be after a pole shift and our expectations about what we can do with electricity and how to be adjusted and what we're to do if the light bulbs all break and what the setup might be to anticipate that situation. Light bulbs do wear out and break. Perhaps light bulbs are not the thing to use. Perhaps there's something we can do to create light. Anyway, welcome back, Mike.
Oh, thank you.
And my first question is, because we did have a session earlier on 12-volt electricity, how batteries work, how electricity works, and how you can rig power generating to charge those batteries. So we're assuming that we have our batteries, and we're prepared to recover them, you know, if they wear out, to maintain them, and perhaps even build new batteries. We have a power generating setup, wind or water, like power on a bike or whatever. So this gives us, presumably, lights at a minimum. But it probably won't run our microwave oven, our washer and dryer, and our video games on the TV or PC, right? Life just won't be the same, I imagine. Huh?
This is very true. Typical person in today's civilization uses in the tens of kilowatt hours per day. After the pole shift, one will be lucky to be able to generate 1,000 times less, or in the tens of watts per day per person. Expect not to use curler irons, coffee makers, toasters, dishwashers, clothes dryers, electric heaters, air conditioning, hot pad, hot plates, blow dryers, popcorn poppers, cooking with electricity, and high-powered tools. Because of the low amount of available power, one will shift to task lighting being the most important. The charging of two-way radios for local and distant communication being second in importance. Occasional laptop computers used to look up needed information as third importance. Super energy efficient small refrigerators and freezers are a better, more efficient choice than Peltier junction coolers and could also be a third choice. Providing a low power source of music may be considered a fourth priority by some and an unneeded luxury by others. This could be made by using a car stereo, CD player, or personal jukebox with a battery-powered external audio amplifier. Battery-operated TV using DVDs or tapes would be another luxury for occasional short-term use. Depending on power availability, growing lights and water distillation is right up there in priority. These take a lot of power that most will not have. Sodium vapor with mercury vapor being second would be the most cost-effective for growing purposes. LEDs have too much initial cost for most used for growing and are best used for task lighting. Task lighting is defined as just enough light directed in the needed direction to do the task at hand. This would be headlamps, flashlights, drop lights, and LED taillights. Energy-efficient LED lighting should be used in preference to anything else if available. As a worst case, low-tech Christmas tree light bulbs could be used. One can take a string of 30 to 40 or 50 bulbs, cut out a section, and run on low voltage direct current. 115 volts divided by the number of bulbs in the full string gives the number of volts needed for each bulb. In this way, one can match the number of bulbs to the voltage of the storage battery in use. 30-string series would translate to a 3.8 volts, and a 40-string would be 2.8 volts, and a 50-string would be 2.3 volts. This would result in needing to use 3 bulbs from a 30-volt string, and 4 bulbs from a 40-volt string, and 5 bulbs from a 50-volt string for a 12-volt battery hookup. That's easy to remember. Krypton and xenon flashlight bulbs are next in efficiency. Fluorescents are next, with LED lighting being the most energy efficient. An LED taillight bulb can be made to use less than half a watt on high and less than 5/1000ths of a watt on low by adding in a proper resistor in series. LED night lights are easy to make using 4 AAA, 4 AA, or 12 volts and a proper series resistor. Amber or yellow is used to avoid bugs for a night light. A night light in this case would be one burning most all of the nighttime hours. White would be used for task lighting and reading. Red is for seeing a distance at night and for indicating danger. Ultraviolet is for attracting bugs into a trap and for spotting fungus, bacteria, urine, and other biologicals. It can be used to find bugs at night. For example, scorpions will glow when an ultraviolet light is shined on them. It can be used to detect problems with skin. Green can be used for signaling that all is okay. Does this answer the questions on this subject?
Yeah, it means we're all going to have diminished expectations about what kind of electrical devices we can be running in a primitive setting. The Bible site said it does have electricity, but needs to use this well. have a general question. What makes an LED, which I guess is a light-emitting diode, whatever the heck that is, superior bulb? What about other light bulbs, and what to do when they wear out? I certainly have to buy bulbs now and then. They just wink out after a certain number of hours and seem to have a little broken wire in there, and I guess it's some sort of a special gas inside of that bulb or a vacuum, something that's not easy for people to make. So we can't necessarily just manufacture light bulbs, and the stores won't be open, so what to do? I found a comparison page on the Troubled Times website that talks about LEDs being superior overall, you know, if you're thinking about cost, longevity, and the like, and I'd like to quote, "I have attempted to formulate an apples-to-apples comparison between three different light sources showing their relative constancy and durability. One is what I consider to be the best-case conventional light source, the high-pressure sodium vapor lamp. One I consider the worst-case conventional light source, automobile headlamps. These lamps have a very short 300-hour lifespan and are not very efficient. However, since there will be many abandoned vehicles around, you might even be able to get these for free. And the third is a new hybrid light source, which is composed of light-emitting diodes, the LEDs, and a blue luminescent tube. This last one, I think, represents our best hope as a light source for use in growing plants without sunlight. The LED component has a lifespan of several decades, 100,000 hours plus, and is very efficient." And then they go through a comparison, and I quote again, "They're using a 23-year lifespan," and I quote again, "High-pressure sodium vapor lamp costs $137, 23-year supply is 5 lamps, total cost $685, and the power requirement is 250 watts, and it'll put out 35 light watts. Then comparing that, automobile headlights, and they're saying use 60 lamps simultaneously. Light power output, 72 light watts. Power requirements is a whopping 1,440 watts. Cost is cheap, only $5. But for a 23-year supply, to keep 60 headlamps going simultaneously, to make it equivalent to this high-pressure sodium vapor lamp, you'd have to have, get this, 4,296 headlights. Total cost, $201,480. Woo. But now the best is LEDs. And there they say the light output is 36 light watts, you know, comparable to the high-pressure sodium vapor lamp. Power requirement, 192 watts, somewhere between, but a lot closer to the high-pressure sodium vapor lamp. Certainly not the whopping 1,400 watts that the headlight would require. Cost, $493. This is assuming a total year supply of one LED array or grouping or whatever that might be. And they're saying this is assuming that you have the ability to rebuild the tube, and I want to know what that means. Total cost, $493. So we have LEDs, low watts required to pump out the light, low cost, pretty good output, way and above, even though it's expensive in the long run, to trying to stock up on all these other things. And let me quote from the conclusion from that page. "The conclusion I hope you draw from this is that the LED tube light is superior. The LEDs will not all fail at once if they are not abused. They will fail one at a time after many years, gradually reducing the output, and are very tolerant to mechanical shock." End of the quote from this page. Well, what do you think, Mike?
Yes, I do agree. If one can afford LEDs, they are more cost-effective than other lighting over a 25-year time frame. There's one danger with LEDs in that they don't take the current. If your current is too high, they'll burn out. Sodium lighting is a close second. I doubt many will be able to afford much more than LED task lighting, unfortunately. To complicate the issue, I found that these LEDs need to be designed to run at no more than half-rated power to get anything close to rated lifetime. A lot of bulb manufacturers today don't know this or don't publish it. I see a lot of problems with current taillights in house bulbs that one can purchase from eBay, their LED. If one buys a 115-volt or 12-volt rendition and test it. One will find out it doesn't last very long before the bulb drops way down in light output. Knowing this, one can modify the taillight bulbs by adding resistance to bring it down to half power and a decent lifetime. Typically, I found this to be in the order of 50 or more ohms for taillight bulbs. 115-volt units are not easily modifiable. Better to make your own. I will be sending more details to TT Forum in the near future on this. Does this answer your question on this subject?
Yeah, what you're saying is it's not all as prompt. Actually, I do recall from reading that page that he's saying a blue light LED LED that allows for plant growth. But to my knowledge, that was experimental and being promised and not really giving the sunlight that we would need to grow plants. But assuming this to be like task lighting, in other words, turn the lights on so we can see what we're doing, then that's a good comparison. And I get the hint that LEDs can be rebuilt, where incandescent light bulbs or neon tubes, for instance, they're tricky to make, but an LED can be rebuilt, and I don't know what a diode is, but LEDs are those, in general, you look at your watch and it's lit up, or you look at your clock on the nightstand, those are LED lights, I think, that are in there, or the little light on your PC that say, I'm off or I'm on. You know, red or green, those are LEDs. They don't burn out. You're not running around with little bulbs trying to screw in some tiny little thing in there. They're very long-lasting, which is why they're put in all these devices. So let me give you an example of this hint that they can be rebuilt, why I think this. Let me quote from a Trouble Times page that talks about the difficulty in making light bulbs. And I quote, current thoughts on how we might make our own gas-filled light bulbs in the future. We would have to blow glass tubes, build in an electrode at each end, evacuate by using several old refrigerator compressors in series. This person says, I have tested refrigeration compressors as vacuum pumps, and they pull a pretty good vacuum. Fill with sodium, mercury, or other substance yet to be determined. Seal at a given low pressure. Apply high voltage to start and a lower voltage to run. The longer the tube and the higher the pressure, the greater the voltage of operation. End of the quote. Well, we're going to blow gas. We're going to evacuate and get a vacuum pump going. And worst of all, fill with sodium, mercury, or other substances. We can't do that in a primitive setting. We're going to be well off even to have enough light and heat and something to cook the supper by and boil our water. So I'm very curious about LEDs being rebuilt and the part that burns out in an LED that can be replaced if it does burn out. Do you know anything about that, Mike?
Yes. LEDs are very current technology. Super bright LEDs are a thing of the past 5 to 10 years. It takes a civilization a while to get up to this level before they start to be able to build these things efficiently. Two things can happen to an LED. It can burn out and not produce any light, or it can fade out and produce very little light for the amount of power input. If an LED is overdriven, then burnout is more likely. The bottom line is there is no way that I know of to rebuild these things. Low pressure lighting would be far more likely to be able to be repaired. For one thing, one could boost the voltage to an existing tube and get a bit more life out of it. Does that answer your question on this?
Oh, yeah, a little bit disappointed, but branching into another and related subject, I've always been enamored of the idea of carbon arc lamp, and I read an article years ago about London at the turn of the century, well, not this century, the last turn, 1900, that the streets of London were as light as day because of carbon arc lamps. They don't have breakable parts because really they're two carbon or graphite points pushed together, little space between them, so that the electricity flowing along there bridges that arc, and it's light as day. And I kept thinking, well, carbon or graphite points, isn't that pencil leads? Aren't they carbon or graphite? And wow, is it possible survival sites can like have a couple of pencil leads, pointing at each other with a little and run electricity through them? And bazap, we have something as light as day. Another thing about carbon arc lamps is they report is really the full spectrum of sunlight. Therefore, you could grow a plant indoors or under kind of a sheltered environment if you had gloomy weather overhead, which we're supposed to have because of all the volcanic dust in the atmosphere for up to 25 years afterwards. Little by little, it'll get clear up during that 25 years, but nevertheless, if you want to have your tomatoes and your lettuce and the like, or you're looking for vitamin D, then sheltered lighting like this, you get your windmills up, is a possibility. So carbon arc lamps are full spectrum sunlight, and as evidence of that, when they used them in the early days of the movies, and because they're so very bright, the actors would get sunburn and often cataracts even if they didn't look away, because you're like looking at the sun. So full spectrum sunlight, yes indeed. Anyway, let me quote from what the Encyclopedia Britannica had to say about carbon arc lamps, and I quote, "The incandescent lamp was not the first electric lamp. Lighting devices employing an electric arc struck between electrodes of carbon had been developed and were in use earlier. Used for street lighting, arc lamps had advantages, including reasonable reliability, high efficiency, and above all, a pleasant color, closely approximating natural sunlight. The light of the arc lamp was particularly kind to the color of the human complexion and the stone of historic buildings. Partly for this reason, these devices were retained in dignified city settings, for example, in the city of London, long after more modern light sources had come into wide use. A device for producing light by maintaining an electric arc across a gap between two conductors. Light comes from the heated ends of the conductors, which are usually carbon rods, as well as from the arc itself. Arc lamps are used in applications requiring great brightness, as in searchlights, large film projectors, and floodlights. Sir Humphrey Davy constructed the first arc lamp in 1807, using a battery of 2,000 cells to create a 4-inch arc between two charcoal sticks. When suitable electric generators became available in the late 1870s, practical use of the arc lamps began. The Yablokov candle, an arc lamp invented by the Russian engineer Paul Yablokov, was used for street lighting in Paris and other European cities from 1878. End of the quote. Sure sounds like a sunlight substitute to me, and it sure sounds like there might be some hope there, because pencil leads will be laying around. You know, every school has them. That's a common item you can buy at office supplies. Schools have stocks of them, and it's possible even, I suppose, to manufacture them. But is this a practical idea for the replacement of the light bulb or the LED or whatever? What do you think, Mike?
Pencil leads will work. You can use that until they run out. Then you have to make your own pencil leads. When you talked about two charcoal sticks being used by Sir Humphrey David, I think they probably misquoted. I think he could not have used two charcoal sticks. I've tried two charcoal sticks. You can't get a flow going. It has to be graphite. Using hard graphite carbon rods made like pencil leads, in a voltage of 45 volts to 60 volts with 2 to 10 amps of DC in a semi-closed environment behind glass, this would be behind glass with cooled airflow, consumes the least amount of carbon and produces the most amount of light for this type of, this is what it gravitated to in the when these things were being made. DC works best, but AC can be used. Current is limited by use of a resistor, if it's a DC, or by use of an inductor. An inductor is just a winding of a whole series of wires around an iron core. This is necessary because of the negative resistance characteristic of the arc. Negative resistance means that as soon as you start the arc, it runs on a lower voltage than it takes to start it. And it acts like it has a lower resistance. Electrodes, when in use, need to be in a slow, continuous motion toward each other in order to maintain a given arc length and to compensate for carbon burnup. All kinds of electromechanical setups were used and are possible. Hissing of the arc indicates electrodes are too close or too much current. Carbon electrodes are classified as molded carbon or forced carbons, depending on how they are manufactured. Forced carbons are higher quality than molded carbons. Good electrodes of average size average about 0.15 ohms per foot. Positive electrode is consumed twice as fast as the negative electrode. Electrodes can be made from other types of carbon, petroleum, coke, charcoal, certain types of coal, lamp black, and carbon black from oil or natural gas, but it is not easy or likely in a primitive environment. Self-baking electrodes are used a lot in electric furnaces used to refine metals. Technique has promise if it can be set up, see patents on the subject. Basically, all of these approaches took a high amount of temperature up in the 1,000 degree C range, and they took an environment that was no air environment, and many of those things I do not see us using in a primitive environment. I had troubles with this subject. Every time I pick up the subject to research it, I ran into a brick wall of complexity with much development needed in the past that had dived out of sight and was not readily available. Finally, after much looking, I realized this was not going to be something the normal primitive survivor person would be able to accomplish. In other words, it took until nearly modern times to develop the process and techniques to make these electrodes. It is as much as an art as it is an engineering effort at extremely high temperatures and current. I tried several experiments at making electrodes from ground-up charcoal to no avail. They would not conduct electricity. I couldn't get them hot enough and compact enough in a no-air environment to make a graphite conducting electrode. I think if one has naturally occurring graphite available, then it might be possible to use the pencil making technique. This would be to fine grind the graphite and add 5 to 10% clay and water, then heat to fuse the clay, making an electrode. The bottom line is if one can find a big enough graphite chunk, use them as electrodes, as is. Does this answer your question?
Oh, very much so. I'm thrilled. My thought about pencil leads, it's a true thing. And if graphite occurs naturally, then this is a true... But I must caution the public, you have to worry about skin cancer and cataracts. You have to treat carbon arc lamps like you do sunlight and not just bask in them, because this is like being out in the sun. But from the standpoint of people who go into a depression if they can't be in sunlight, just imagine... Put on your sunglasses, go down and work in the hydroponics under the carbon arc lamp, get your half an hour of exposure to sunlight, and boost your mood, get your vitamin D generated in your own skin. It really holds hope. And so I'm glad I brought it up and was so persistent about it. And kudos to you, Mike, for experimenting with all that stuff. You roll up your sleeves and delve right in there. There is nobody who has contributed to Troubled Times in the survival solution area like you have. And I thank you once again for coming on and sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
For human health, as we need sunlight to manufacture vitamin D and often to keep from getting sad or depressed, our light needs to be full spectrum. Plants need this also to grow indoors or in sheltered environments. What does the term full spectrum light really mean? And I quote from the Troubled Times pages, "It used to be that full spectrum lighting meant lights which produce both ultraviolet B and A and the full visible spectrum, as well as infrared heat. Once incandescence manufacturers figured out that people were being told to look for full spectrum lighting, they started to market their wide spectrum lights with full spectrum in the ads and on packaging. In fact, incandescents are just producing, if they are putting out bright white light, only the visible spectrum. Fluorescent light manufacturers weren't slow to get on this bandwagon either, unfortunately, as not all fluorescents produce UV wavelengths." End of the quote. And our regular incandescent bulbs don't cut it unless they're sun lamp bulbs. LEDs, those little light-emitting diodes, also do not cut it unless they include in the array expensive blue light LEDs. NASA studied this problem for the space station where fresh vegetables are grown for the astronauts. And I quote from the Troubled Times pages, "According to the summary published by NASA in conjunction with several universities, blue is essential to plant growth. Recommendation from that study is from 1 to 20% blue LEDs, depending on plant and growth requirements. Blue LEDs are out because they're so very costly. Please note that NASA used blue fluorescent lights as the supplementary blue light source. This is why I recommend the use of neon lights. The neon is the only routinely rebuildable light source I am aware of, and is long-lasting at that, 5 to 10 years. True, a certain web of technologies must be maintained to support neon tubes, and you must be willing to deal with a modest amount of toxic mercury. I know of no other alternative for blue light. The luminous tube will also be able to supply needed ultraviolet light for disinfecting and vitamin D production." End of the quote. Well, this was during our struggle to find a light source that would survive the pole shift or be able to be rebuilt and replaced after the pole shift. Wow. Mercury vapor? Mercury poison? One more reason to go with carbon arc light. Toxic mercury at the survival camps? Brain damage? Here we come. Fluorescent bulbs, as with neon, also contain mercury vapor, but they're more efficient in consumption of precious electricity. And I quote again from the Troubled Times pages, from a book called How Things Work, written by a professor of physics at the University of Virginia. "The hot filament of an incandescent bulb delivers only about 10% of its electric power as visible light. In contrast, a fluorescent tube delivers about 25% of its electric power as visible light, and some gas discharge bulbs, particularly low-pressure sodium vapor, deliver as much as 50% of their electric powers as visible light. To the question how much light is consumed each time you turn on a fluorescent bulb, the answer, a typical fluorescent tube will last about 50,000 hours if left on continuously, but only 20,000 hours if it's turned on for just 3 hours at a time. To the question, how do they work? The answer is, a fluorescent tube uses an electric discharge in mercury vapor to produce ultraviolet light, which is then transformed into visible light by fluorescent phosphors on the inner surface of the tube. To the question, what is the composition of the phosphors used in fluorescent light bulbs? The answer, the exact composition depends on the color type of the bulb, with the most common color types being cool white, warm white, deluxe cool white, and deluxe warm white. In each case, the phosphors are a mixture of crystals that may include calcium halophosphate, calcium silicate, strontium magnesium phosphate, calcium strontium phosphate, and magnesium fluoromagnate. These crystals contain impurities that allow them to fluoresce visible light. These impurities include antimony, magnesium, tin, and lead. To the question, do regular fluorescent lights emit ultraviolet light? If so, how does the ultraviolet level compare to what we would receive if we were outside? And the answer? Virtually all of this ultraviolet light is absorbed by the tube's internal phosphor coating and glass envelope. As a result, a fluorescent lamp emits relatively little ultraviolet light, far less than that of outdoor sunlight. End of the quote. Well, this just sounds worse and worse. Where would one ever get all those odd vapors to put into a tube to replace their broken fluorescent light? And is it worth it when we really don't get that much ultraviolet for vitamin D, for reducing our depression, or for growing plants indoors? All these drawbacks. The issues seem to be, when comparing these light bulbs and gas tubes, 1, the ability to replicate full-spectrum sunlight, 2, efficient use of electricity, and 3, toxic components, and 4, the ability to rebuild the bulb. How do we stack up? Incandescent light bulbs do not produce full-spectrum light and break, and require delicate filaments, glass-blowing equipment and skills, and a vacuum production, the ability to produce a vacuum, in order to manufacture them. LEDs only produce full-spectrum if expensive blues are included, and cannot be rebuilt in survival camps, and are not all that bright, so one must have many as an array, which is expensive. Neon and fluorescent have poisonous gases in them, can and do produce full-spectrum light, but to replace in a survival camp risks mercury and or lead poisoning. Halide bulbs are full-spectrum, but to be rebuilt include the problems with incandescent bulb manufacture with the addition of special gases, sodium halide and the like. Carbon arc produces full-spectrum light, is very bright light at the level of sunlight, and requires only graphite points such as pencil leads for replacement, but does require a strong direct current push in order to operate, therefore is the least efficient use of precious electricity. So there it is. Looking back at the hour where we described 12-volt electricity, direct current versus alternating current, power-generating methods such as bike gen and wind and water mills, and recharging and rebuilding our battery packs, as well as this past hour discussing how to translate electricity to light and what to do when all the light bulbs break, it all seems kind of a struggle. For those not thrilled about pumping up their batteries on bike racks, rebuilding their batteries by scrounging for metal parts and making fluid out of wood ash wash, and fussing with pencil lead points for a bit of full-spectrum sunlight, the alternatives are grim. Getting light from fuels, oil or gas or coal or even wood, may not be that likely either. Trees, the forests, will die before being reborn, and after a while will be rotted or burned for fuel. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Rebirth, written in July 1995. Trees will, in the main, die, as they will not have stores of energy that can be tapped and rely on annual sunlight to maintain those portions of themselves that are alive. Then how do trees survive, pole shift after pole shift? Seedlings, in fact, survive better, and many seeds do not sprout until years later. It only takes a few sprouting seeds to perpetuate the species. Seedlings are tiny compared to the giant parent, and thus can move along with fewer nutrients. In fact, it is the seedling trees, growing a few years after the shift, that should be nurtured, not the dying parents. Just as after a forest fire, those are the trees of the future. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. Natural gas will be dangerous. Most refineries will explode, and any stores of gasoline or propane likely to prove murderous during the pole shift itself. And I quote from Zeta Talk, Storing Fuel, written November 2002. We have stated that fossil fuels will soon run out, so should not be relied upon by survivors for the long term. We have also stated that refineries and storage tanks of oil and natural gas and gasoline will be broken and set afire during the shift, creating a holocaust for all nearby. Likewise, gasoline stations, fuel pumps, and even tightly sealed tanks may rupture and leak, also a continuing danger for any nearby. Natural gas lines in streets will run fire along the street, setting houses ablaze where they would otherwise not be in such danger. Natural gas in lines under cities will cause explosions, setting the cities on fire and burning many trapped citizens in a painful death. We would advise all to do what Nancy did, which is to turn off the natural gas lines at the house, turn off at the street, and avoid gas cans or anything that can explode. What do you gain by a few cans of gas? A few hours of heat or light? What do you stand to risk in exchange? Your life? A painful death to others? Since you're going to have to adjust to life without these explosive fuels in any case, and soon, learn to get along without them. End of the quote from Zeta Talk. If one does not have electricity and is going the utterly crude route, there is always burning oil or animal fat. This is similar to a wax candle. And I quote from a description on how to do this from the Troubled Times pages. A very efficient lamp for light and low heat can be made in the most primitive situations if one has the carcass of an animal. Even the leanest will have some body fat stored, sometimes under the skin, but most always can be found around the internal organs, especially the kidney area. Ball up whatever you can, say to about fist size. This basically will be your candle. A wick can be made from any plant fiber string or twisted from a strip of garment, like a cotton garment. This kind of cordage can be made from many barks, grasses, or plant fibers. Wick diameter can be as one desires. Larger wicks burn brighter, but they burn faster. Melt a small quantity of fat in a depression in a rock next to the fire, and soak the wick thoroughly. Form the ball firmly around the wick, and you're set. It's best to place this candle in a fireproof container, such as a hollow rock, to catch the fat as it melts. As it burns and melts, it will render itself, the cracklings settling and the pure fat rising. The wick will eventually drown in the oil, so try to keep the burning portion out of the pool of oil. End of the quote from Troubled Times. Ah, it all seems such a struggle. Any advice from Zeta Talk? And I quote from Zeta Talk, Generating Electricity, written December 2002. Modern man is much dependent upon electricity, though only having arrived there within the last 100 years or so. In primitive countries, communities work hard during the day, sleep at dusk, rise at dawn, and have little need of lights except for the occasional lamp or campfire. In pre-industrial days, this was likewise the mode. Even the interiors of castles and palaces lit only by lamps, and then dimly. Modern man expects labor-saving devices, and entertainment, communication with the world, all at the press of a button. Modern man will have to do a mega mind shift after the pole shift if he thinks this will continue, as his life will be less than communities a century ago for the following reasons. 1. Where in the past, sunlight even on gloomy days could be anticipated, after the shift, for most parts of the world, the light available will seem like going from dawn to dusk, skipping the middays entirely. 2. Oils and materials to burn for light will be scarce or water-soaked, what with continuous drizzle in much of the world, so fires will be a treasured occurrence from carefully dried materials. 3. Batteries and generators will wear out within months after continuous use by the desperate, with the shock of what has descended only coming late to these, not avoided. 4. Petrol fuels, or fuels from vegetation such as corn or wood gas will run out without the means to pump, refine, or grow in the gloom. 5. The lack of parts for mechanical repair, lack of skills in those isolated, and lack of success with crops will doom all plans for fields to be burned in the aftertime. 6. Skills to build generators collecting power from wind and water will be spotty, and the missing link theory applied endlessly, such that a single link, like battery storage, dooms the plans. In light of all this, what can mankind expect? Nancy has been practicing, walking about her house for months now, in the dark, such that she must grope to steady herself and use touch, not sight, as a guide. Lights are used only when absolutely necessary. Practice this and see how little you need light to walk through your day. Storytelling, group singing, eating and washing, enjoying the sounds and smells of the evening, none of this requires more than light enough to make out dim shapes. Those who are used to electric lights, and in groups where the lack of this has plunged the group into depression, have avenues to generate this. Exercise is one of the great depression lifters, and racks of old bicycles where the complainers pumping away is not only a means of generating lights during the session, it is a group activity. Group therapy thus becomes an exercise session where the 12-volt batteries are replenished, and perhaps the children would like to put on a play, practicing in the dark when they are all put to bed and should be sleeping. Whispered plans to surprise the adults. The bike gents can provide a floodlight for their stage. Thus, it is not so much a loss as a challenge, an opportunity to be resourceful, as all of life is. End of the quote from Zeta Talk.
I'm Roger, president of Troubled Times Incorporated. We're a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping mankind survive during troubled times when self-sufficiency may be the only answer. Our organization offers a twin set CD of survival information at cost to the public. The CDs are in hypertext and PDF format, two popular browser formats, and contain all the information collected by the massive Troubled Times website. The CDs allow you to browse this information offline at your leisure. The cost of the twinned pair is $4.10, and this includes postage. You can also get the survival booklet, a hip-sized booklet of the gift of the Troubled Times advice, for just $5, including postage. We offer a popular combo package for $7.50 that includes both the CDs and the booklet, with the lower postage expense reflected in that price. Send for your copies today to start making practical plans for your and your family's survival. Just click on the $4.10 CD link at www.zetatalk.com, and your copy will be on its way.
That concludes our broadcast. Thank you for being with us. Remember to carry love in your heart. It's the commodity of the future. As the Zetas say, love may have a blooming going into the shift, as it ought, those with great love in their hearts responding to the realization that little else matters.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a BloginService.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.